Class is in session. You're listening to Squat University by Dr. Aaron Horshick.
Let's go!
Now, let's start the show.
Podcast listeners, thank you so much for checking out today's show. This is episode 40 of the Squat University podcast. The goal with each and every one of these shows is to bring you as much value-packed content to help you move better in the gym and in life, decrease your body's aches and pains, and help you reach your true athletic potential. Today, I'm joined by the world's leading expert on tendon injuries. Her research has been instrumental in my own learning and treatments of my own patients. So if you're currently dealing with patellar tendon pain or Achilles tendon pain, or have dealt with those injuries in the past, or you are working with an athlete complaining of a tendon injury, get ready for some great content. Professor Jill Cook, thank you so much for joining me on today's show. For those out there who do not know of your work and your background, can you just give a brief introduction for everyone out there?
Yeah, thank you, Aaron. It's a delight to be here. I'm a physical therapist, and worked in the clinic with basketball particularly, and was really frustrated with the whole process of how to manage patellar tendinopathy in particular. So went to the literature, couldn't find anything, and then thought, well, we better do some research. And that was in 1995. And here we are 20 odd years later, and we're still going. And we're so excited about how we've managed to really get a better understanding, both in the process of tendon pathology and pain, but also in how we can help people.
Very cool. Now, as far as the whole process of the tendon injury, obviously, patellar tendon injury, like you mentioned, is probably one of the most common complaints I see, especially in the CrossFitters that we see that do a lot of running and explosive lifts with the Olympic lifts. Can you explain for everyone out there sort of how the process of a tendon injury starts in the first place?
Yeah, it's really important to realize that the process of pathology is different from the process of pain, and that you can have extensive and long-term pathology but actually never know you have it because it never becomes painful. So the process of pathology seems it starts with excess load on the tendon and probably excess spring-like load, so too much change of direction, too much jumping, too many sprints. That sort of stuff seems to be the thing that starts the pathology process. And depending on how much of that you do, how much your tendon moves through the process towards degeneration. Now, pain comes either with that process or can come completely separate to that process.
Interesting. So someone could develop a pathology. Basically, their tendons could start degrading and they would never have pain at all. Is that correct?
That's absolutely correct. There's a seminal paper in 1991 by Canis and Yoza. What they showed in a big cohort of people who'd ruptured is that they're all degenerative and profoundly degenerative, and you have to have a degenerative tendon to be able to rupture. You can't rupture normal tendon. 66% of the people who ruptured had never had a symptom in their life. So, in fact, more people with degenerative tendon pathology don't have symptoms than do have symptoms.
Interesting. Now, one of your landmark research articles was on the continuum of pathology. Can you sort of explain what that continuum is and how someone would progress along the continuum?
Okay, so when I started looking into pathology, inflammation was thought to be the primary driving pathology behind it. And then there was a separate sort of group of thought that was about collagen tearing. Now, neither of those made sense because back in the 80s and 90s, when I was a clinician, we tried the anti-inflammatory approach and it didn't work. So rest and ice and non-steroidals made no difference to our tendons. And the collagen tearing approach made no sense either in terms of if you tear collagen, you actually should stimulate some sort of response in the tendon, and that's not what we were seeing. So we put together, Craig Purdom and I, put together our clinical experiences over many years and many red wines into what's called a continuum, where we thought the originating process was the cell within the tendon that was sensitive to the overload, and the response of the tendon cell then drove all the consequent changes in the tendon matrix, preferentially excretion of proteoglycans and attraction of water into the tendon, that's in a secondary response change the collagen matrix. So the collagen tearing, in inverted commas, is the final stage of the process, or penultimate stage of the process. So that was a completely different way of thinking about it. It really fitted with what we saw clinically, in terms of we could stage people in this continuum, and it helped us change our treatment or target our treatments at the stage of pathology.
Interesting. So basically, an athlete comes to you, in most of the time they're having pain, if they're going to come in at all. And so you would say when they have pain, they're at least experiencing the reactive phase of that continuum, correct?
That's right.
The overload is what causes the reaction, correct?
And that's
that,
right.
That overload could be very different for a different athlete, correct? It's not always the exact same amount. How would someone's tendon become reactive in the first place?
Now, as you say, somebody who is a sprinting athlete, their load is very high. The tendon is very adapted to extreme loads repeatedly through the week. But in those athletes, something as simple as a change in track surface or a change in shoes can make enough of a change to the tendon to actually send it into some sort of overload and get a reaction within the tendon. So that's in that end of the spectrum. At the other end of the spectrum, what we see is people who change their activity from a very low base, or being more sedentary. So here in Australia, we see a lot of our older people who pack up their bags and head off on a trip overseas. They do much more walking than they're used to. They're carrying a suitcase. And they come back with a plethora of tendon injuries because it's not what they're used to doing. So any load that exceeds what you're doing will have the potential to create a reaction in the tendon.
Gotcha. And I think the one thing I commonly see is a lot of athletes who will be very, very well trained, and they'll go on a vacation, or they'll take a large deload, and then they'll jump right back into really heavy training. And that same constant, or that very varied training level, could also send someone into a reaction. Is that correct?
Absolutely. So as soon as you change the load down on a tendon, it changes its capacity. So we think that the tendon starts to change in terms of its mechanical stiffness within 2 to 3 weeks. So if you have 4 to 6 weeks off, your muscle and your tendon and your kinetic chain and possibly your brain are all deconditioned to the level that you used to be at. And then if you go immediately back to that level, you're actually placing excess load on the tendon. So it's in fact the rest and the deconditioning that's induced the overload. And we see this very commonly in athletes, or in recreational people who have time off in the off season. So they have a tendon problem in the season. Physio says better rest in the off season so you'll be fitter for next year and you won't have a tendon problem. They do nothing. They decondition, capacity of the tendon drops. They come back into a high load training environment and their tendon's actually worse. And so one of our sort of adages of tendon management is never rest a tendon. Always keep a load on it and try and aim to keep a stimulus on it that you want that tendon to be adapted to.
So it makes sense why the idea of recovery does not mean complete rest, because then you are just deconditioning your tendon so that when you do jump back into your training, it's also a good idea to have sort of a few weeks of a ramp up, I guess, in intensity and in volume of working. You're not jumping straight back into what you were prior doing.
Yes, tendons don't like change. That's what another adage we say to our patients. So you have to make sure that the tendon thinks it's doing about the same load that it's used to. And by doing your ramping in, what you're doing is sort of gradually increasing the load on the tendon, but slow enough for the tendon to think that it's doing the same thing. So it's a bit of a tricking of the tendon to make it think that it's not being overloaded. And if you're smart about it, and we often say time down equals time up. So if you have 8 weeks off, then your ramp in needs to be about 8 weeks. Now, no evidence for that. And clinically, it's variable, of course, but I think that's a really good sort of starting point to think about.
That makes sense. Now, could someone jump, like you said, that reactive phase and go directly into degeneration or the disrepair, or will they just not have pain with the reactive phase, like you said?
As best we know, and we have a little bit of research on the early stages, it's very hard to get tissue samples in the early stages of pathology, but the principle of the continuum would be the process is you must go through that reactive stage. It may or may not be painful, and it's that that then leads you to the disrepair and the degeneration. So, yes, the process we think is exactly the same. It's just when you actually feel pain.
That makes sense. Now, obviously, like I said, when someone comes to us as practitioners, they are often in pain. You're not going to get someone that's like, I think I have a degeneration in my tendon. And clearly, we know that they're in the reactive phase. But there's also that clinical staging. We can say you're reactive or you're reactive on degeneration. Can you explain sort of the difference between the two and how that would differentiate maybe our first steps in the treatment process?
Yeah. So a truly reactive tendon is quite an unusual presentation. It tends to be in a younger person with an acute overload. So we don't see a lot of them. Perhaps the one that we see, more commonly is someone who's had a direct blow on the tendon. So if you slip off your bike and drive the pedal into the back of your Achilles or fall over and hit your patellar tendon on stone, you can get this massive reactive response. So that can be seen. The reactive process in a younger athlete will stick out very clearly. So we see it in young basketballers often. They're used to training 2 to 3 times a week. They go into an elite camp environment. Instead of 2 to 3 times a week, they're training 2 to 3 times a day for 7 days. And their tendons just cave in and they just can't tolerate that. Pretty much outside of that, those two situations, you're almost always going to be dealing with a reactive on degenerative tendon. And people will say, oh, no, I've never had a tendon problem. And the answer is, yes, you've never had tendon pain, but you probably have a degeneration underlying that. And you can sort of get an idea from that to saying things like, have you ever been stiff in your Achilles in the morning? Oh, yeah, occasionally every second or third month I'll do something and I get a bit stiff in my tendon. That's a very low-grade tendon response. It goes away in a couple of days. People don't, think about it very often, until they do something really silly and they get a full-blown reactive degenerative tendon. So just gentle questioning, looking at the tendon, getting a history of what's happened on the other side, that sort of stuff can give you really good clues that it's probably got an underlying degenerative component. And certainly once you're over 30 or 40, it's much more likely to be degenerative or reactive on degenerative than a purely reactive tendon.
Will there be any physical changes that we can see palpation-wise on a tendon that will be reactive on degeneration?
You can see changes in a tendon that is degenerative, particularly the Achilles. This is obviously more true of some tendons. The Achilles is the one that you can see most, and that can look lumpy and bumpy or thicker. Very hard to pick up those changes in the patellar tendon, in the hamstring tendon, in the adductor tendon, glute tendon. You can't actually see those. Just going to palpation, because another adage of ours is that palpation's really not a good examination. We never, ever touch tendons. But the reason is it just gives you a whole gamut of false positives. So people are tender in their tendons, and it doesn't actually help you diagnose the problem.
So just pushing on your Achilles tendon and just pushing on your patellar tendon, if it's painful, that alone does not mean you have a patellar or an Achilles tendinopathy. What is the best way to determine whether or not you have that?
Okay, so we have 2 or 3 things that you must have to have tendon pain. And I can't emphasize this enough. Pretty much 70% of people we see referred to us with patellar tendinopathy don't have it. In fact, they have patellofemoral pain, and it's diagnosed by other clinicians as changes on imaging, which doesn't mean anything, and palpation soreness, which doesn't mean anything. So the things that we place our diagnosis on is localized pain that stays localized. So for the patellar tendon, it must be a single finger. They must point to the inferior pole of their tendon. Load-dependent increases in pain. So as you increase the energy storage, the spring-like loads on your tendon, your pain should go up, and it should stay localized. So very often we see people who point to their inferior pole of their patellar tendon. We put them through a loading program and ask them all the time, how much pain do you have? Is it increasing with the load? Where is your pain? Is it staying in the same place? And what we see is once we start to load up, the pain starts to spread either up and down the tendon or across the base of the patella. That is not going to be patellar tendinopathy. And we've been surprised, and we're very excited about some research we're doing at the moment. So it's actually a lot less common than what people think. Very common in elite basketball, in jumping men, but very uncommon anywhere else.
So you say it's very load dependent. So that means a jump, two-legged jump, will create more pain if it is truly patellar tendinopathy than a bodyweight squat, correct?
Absolutely. And a single leg jump or a deceleration, a stop jump is the highest load on the patellar tendon. That should create much more pain than a squat, which is a slow movement, no energy storage. So take people through from double leg slow movement, single leg slow movement, double leg faster movement, single leg faster movement, maximum end of load. And we expect to see that pain go from 1 to 3 to 5 to 7 to 8, across that spectrum of loads.
That makes sense. Now, if we have someone who, if they're only squatting and their complaints of pain rise with, you know, a bodyweight squat to 100 kilos to 200 kilos, on the way up, they have more pain. Obviously, that's not increasing the spring-like capabilities of the knee unless they're maybe very plyometric and bouncing out of the bottom of a squat. Are we saying that's probably more of a patellofemoral pain syndrome than a tendinopathy?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And where the pain is will give you the other clue. And the history of pain. So people will come in and say, I have pain when I'm running. Is it worse when you're running downhill? No, it seems to be worse when I run uphill. Well, that's not going to be patellar tendon. You'd be surprised at the number of 40 and 50-year-olds we get sent with patellar tendinopathy based on imaging and palpation diagnosis. You don't have it at that age. Pretty much you've got to be below the age of 30. You've got to be a jumping athlete and you've got to be a man unless you're a very elite woman. That's the group that we think truly have patellar tendon problems. Now, this is a problem because the research is not including an isolated group. They're including a group that have different knee pathologies, and then the results are heterogeneous. That's because you've got a heterogeneous group going in. And so it starts to really cloud our understanding of what the best treatment is for these conditions. So, we have to do better at that.
Yeah. Now, you said obviously the clinical and clinical imaging and the palpation. I see a lot of patients, and that's all the referring physician has ever done. They look at it, maybe they touch it, maybe they don't, but they order in a very expensive MRI. So basically, we will see possible degenerative changes in the patellar tendon. But the reason that person is having pain is not due to their tendinopathy. It could be due to a patellofemoral injury, which therefore would dictate a very different type of treatment plan.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And the number of people that we see who have for years been put onto interventions for their tendons, so injections into the area of pathology, or treatments, so eccentric programs and isometric programs for their tendon pain, when the actual diagnosis isn't tendon pain, is huge. And, we have to be better at this, at getting our diagnosis, our source of pain. You can diagnose them having tendon pathology, but you can't say the tendon is the source of pain, and that's the difference. And people really don't discriminate well enough between that. But doing a tendon treatment for a patellofemoral pain will be the worst thing you do. They do not like patellofemoral pains, do not like high loads. You can't put them on a heavy leg extension program, whereas people with patellar tendon love high loads. You can see differences immediately in their response to treatment.
If we have someone that does show on an MRI, does show degenerative changes, we think, however, based on our clinical examination, that their pain is coming from more of a patellofemoral. Do we ignore the fact that they had degenerative changes in their tendon? Like, can we do isometrics still, like a wall sit? Would that still be appropriate, or just don't worry about the patellofemoral pain and don't treat what you see, the degeneration, I guess?
don't treat the imaging. That's becoming increasingly clear across so many musculoskeletal conditions at the moment. Imaging leads you astray most of the time. Treat the person in front of you. Treat what they're missing. Treat what you think the source of the pain is. The imaging has absolutely no place in diagnosis, no place in prognosis, and it's not an outcome measure. It's not going to get better with treatment.
That would make sense. And part of that, is it because whenever you see a degenerated tendon and there's parts of the tendon islands, I guess you would say, that have the disrupted collagen, the tendon can actually, I guess for a simple way of saying it, can actually grow more healthy tissue. Is that correct?
That's right. That's Sean Docking's work. Mm-hmm. And what he showed in the Achilles and the patella tendon is that, and this is has to be listened to a couple of times to make it clear to people, a degenerative tendon actually has more normal or good tendon structure than a normal tendon. So the body's not stupid. It will never leave you short of tissue to tolerate load and to take load. So when you have an area of degeneration, you have an increase in the area of good tissue that allows you to continue to take load. Now, from a physiotherapy or physical therapy perspective, it means that we should never be shy of loading these tendons because the tendon's perfectly capable of taking it. We don't have to worry about the area of pathology. That's pretty indolent. It just sits there. It's not changing very much. We have plenty of good tissue that we can load that can make the person completely functional and pain-free.
And that would be also a reason why when we have more healthy tissue surrounding the islands of degeneration, why we need to really focus on the sort of the heavy, slow resistance exercises, correct, that are going to increase the strength of that tendon. Is that as far as our treatment plan goes, correct?
Yeah, certainly heavy, slow resistance has a lot of very positive effects. It affects the muscle of the muscle tendon unit, but it increases the mechanical stiffness of the tendon. Now, that's pretty much what we want to do because a strong muscle controls the load through the tendon. A stiff tendon, a stiffer spring, is more able to tolerate higher energy storage and release loads. So heavy slow resistance is a building block. It's an essential start to a tendon rehabilitation program.
Before we get, I want to talk about that for just a little bit longer, but I had one question quick going back a second. For the patellar tendon pain that we have, you mentioned that it was right at the inferior pole of the patella. Will anyone ever have patellar tendinopathy and have pain in the mid tendon or at the tendon's insertion on the tibia? Do you ever see that at all, or is it only at the inferior pole of the patella?
Okay, so mid tendon, no. There's a case series of 7 people, I think, that have had a direct blow. That's pretty much the only way you can get a tendinopathy or tendon pathology in the middle part of the patella tendon. The inferior attachment, yes, because it's often a consequence of Osgood Schlatter as kids grow up, where you do too much load, you disrupt the attachment of the tendon to the tibia. We get changes in the actual attachment site, but also in the tendon. So you can have symptoms at that end, either as an adolescent or as you are an adult where you've had the condition when you're adolescent and now you have tendon pain associated with the pathology in the tendon at that end.
Okay. Now, how is Oscar Slider related at all to patellar tendinopathy? Because those are a little bit different, correct?
Yes and no. So Osgood Schlatter is a condition of, it's an apophysitis where you probably load too much as the tendon is trying to mature. So the tendon attachment is trying to mature. And we have a little bit of research to show that it's quite a complex process of attaching that tendon to the tibia, and too much load has the potential to change the way it attaches, and then you leave yourself vulnerable to symptoms later on. Interestingly enough, we have some preliminary research to show that's exactly what happens at the proximal end, that the tendon matures about 1 to 2 years post-peak height velocity, so it's an adolescent condition, and too much load in adolescence disrupts the patella tendon attachment to the patella. That then you then develop a pathology, you are then vulnerable to symptoms. So We have pretty much changed our ideas on patellar tendon pathology in that we think it occurs in young men, particularly aged 14 and 15. And that's when the actual problem arises. They may develop symptoms in their 20s, but the actual pathology develops exactly like the other end of the tendon, not quite exactly, but the same stage of adolescence as the distal end of the tendon.
Very interesting. So I want to get back to the heavy, slow resistance. So if we're talking about treatment plan, someone comes to us, they're in the reactive stage, either reactive or reactive on degeneration. Usually isometrics are one of the first different treatments that we give people. I know when looking through a number of the research articles, for example, patellar tendinopathy, we're seeing like a wall sit. 5 for 45 seconds is obviously a very general recommendation. Those are usually to be done relatively pain-free, correct?
Yeah. Yes. So isometrics in an injury will be relatively pain-free. They can sometimes have low levels of pain for the first repetition, but the pain should decrease and be gone by the third repetition. And this is a great diagnostic test as well, because if your pain is not changing or going up, then you have to go back and revisit your diagnosis. So isometrics should take away pain over that five repetitions. Just to comment on your wall squats, that's just not enough load for a patellar tendon. Now, if we go back to who gets patellar tendon problems, young jumping men, we need to put these people on a leg extension machine and put a lot of weight on them to get a reasoned response to isometrics.
So a leg extension would be more load, enough to create the isometric change in the tendon, correct?
Yes, whatever happens with isometrics, we're not absolutely clear how it modifies pain and modulates pain. We know it has a cortical effect. We know it has a local effect as well. We do not know what the local effect is, but what we do know is that five repetitions conditions the tendon, so actually sort of makes the tendon, what's the word I want, it conditions it to a single, a final length, which then you can take the loads on. So it's something about the heavy load. When Ebony Rio did this research, she piloted it for 18 months. She found that light loads didn't work. She found that short loads didn't work. She found that it had to be long and it had to be heavy to have the same effect. So that's what we aim for in our treatment.
Was there a recommendation for exactly how much load is needed in order to get those effects? Like could you, for example, do a single leg wall squat and hold weight in your hands to create enough an effect? Or would you definitely need to be on like a leg press or leg extension machine?
So for most other tendons, you can get away with body weight loads, the Achilles, the hamstring, the glute med, because it tends to be in a group that are often a little bit older, and often a little bit more deconditioned. What we find in the patellar tendon, because it's young jumping men, that's still not enough load. So Ebony's work was done at 70% MIVC, so maximum isometric voluntary contraction, so it was really quite heavy. And we find that you just don't get enough load with those sorts of, particularly the wall squat, it's just not enough load. And the way we set it clinically, you can't always test 70% MIVC in a clinic, but you want to be able to hold the weight for the 45 seconds, but only just. So you need to have good control for 45 seconds, but it really is pushing you pretty hard in terms of towards the limit of what you can hold. Now, you know, I'm a deconditioned old lady and I can do a wall squat for 45 seconds on a single leg and actually not feel, you know, yeah, I'm feeling a little bit of pain, but I can probably do it for another, 45 seconds. So for me, that's an indication that's not enough load. Even for me, for a young jumping man, it's not going to be enough.
That would make sense. Now, obviously, you recommended using a leg extension machine. If you did not have access to that, would you find sufficient force if you were doing like a leg press machine where you're laying on your back?
Yeah. The leg press machine gets us into trouble a little bit because it spreads a load over three joints. So the thing about isometrics has to be they're heavy and they're long. So as soon as you give it three joints to work over, the affected joint will tend to have a little bit of a party. So we are pretty definite for the patella tendon. The only other thing that will give you the same load is Spanish squat. So that's the squat belt where you put it around the back of your tibia and you sit back down. That will give us similar loads, and we do use that for athletes on the road who can't always get to a leg extension. But we're pretty definite in our young men that this is what they need to do. And a leg extension usually, you know, these are young active men, can usually be found if you need one. But other tendons, absolutely agree, can't send everybody to a gym, but you don't need to as much in other tendons.
Is there a specific knee flexion range of motion that's optimal, I guess, when you're doing those isometrics?
Yeah, we will often just let them self-select, but it seems 60 degrees will give us the highest load. So what we found in the Achilles, there's been a few studies in the Achilles where isometrics haven't been successful. For example, one was done in seated, as a seated calf raise in plantar flexion. Both of those reduce the load on the Achilles tendon substantially. So we would advocate to mid towards outer range as the range that you need to be in for all tendons.
Very interesting. I hadn't thought of the Spanish squat before. That would be a very interesting use of for a lot of athletes that I work with. They work out in CrossFit gyms, for example, where there's not many machines, mm-hmm. mostly barbells mm-hmm. And dumbbells, kettlebells. But with the Spanish squat, that would allow them to potentially use a heavy belt and still perform the desired force. Would they be then holding a weight potentially if it just body weight was too tough, or is just sitting back enough probably for them to get the desired effect?
Just sitting back is enough for them to get the desired effect. In our super duper elite athletes, so Angel Bassis has a study where he's done this in elite jumping athletes. He progresses them from a 90-90, so a sit position, to extending through their hips so they actually lie back down. You don't need weights for a Spanish squat. If you can sit, and I know it's double leg, we always advocate single leg, but for the Spanish squat, double legs, plenty of load, and you can add load by changing your hip angle. And if anybody can lie back at 90 degrees with a Spanish squat, you should be an elite jumping athlete.
What are the big differences? Obviously, we've talked a little bit about the patellar tendinopathy. What are the big differences we see between patellar and Achilles tendinopathy?
Okay, tons. What we're learning as we go through this whole process of research and of trying to apply it clinically is we used to think tendons were all the same, and what we've found is they're not. You know, we find quite distinct differences between them. So just to go back and highlight that we think the pathology in the patellar tendon starts in adolescence, and it's a developmental issue. Doesn't happen in the Achilles. So they're very different from when the pathology starts. They're very different in terms of Achilles tendon can affect anybody across the lifespan, and it's actually very prevalent in postmenopausal women and elite sprinting athletes, young ones. So it can hit anybody across the lifespan, whereas our patellar tendon is very much young jumping men and pretty much no one else. So there's profound differences between them just from that perspective. But if you go to the Achilles, again, we're not talking one entity here. We're talking a mid-tendon problem. Achilles is pretty much the only tendon we have trouble with that fails in the mid-tendon. We're talking a bone-tendon junction, so an insertional Achilles. We're talking peritendon issues. We're talking a plantaris issue. So if we talked about differential diagnosis in the patellar tendon being problematic, in the Achilles, it's triple or quadruple the issue, because you actually have four different diagnoses that potentially need to be treated in a different way. Then you have different ages, different genders, different activities. So, you know, people talk about a recipe for Achilles tendon, and for me it's just a silly idea just because it presents in so many different ways.
Clinically, what would be the best way to differentiate the different types of Achilles tendinopathy?
Okay, so insertion is relatively simple because your pain is down at the insertion. Funny about that. tends to be more lateral. But having said that, there are differential diagnoses around there as well. So you do have to make sure you have a tendon problem there as much as you have to be sure you have a tendon problem with the patellar tendon. So that one's simple. Your peritendon from your mid tendon, the loads will be completely different. Their history will be completely different. Their examination will be completely different. So a peritendon is an issue of friction. So someone will have done something that involves a lot of plantar flexion and dorsiflexion, not necessarily with a lot of load. So the loading environment will be completely different, or the load that initiated their pain will be different. Their response to your loading tests, you know, the slow double, slow single, fast double, fast single in a peritendon will be completely different. They won't get an increase in pain across that. Those things, because it will be much more about movement. So often they're better on the faster ones than they are on the slower ones, because on the slower ones you're forcing them to go through a range of motion, whereas when they hop they can actually control the amount of movement. So, you know, you can, you know, do the old does it squeak, but a lot of people with peritendon problems, you can't hear and they can't look crepitus. It's there, but you can't actually detect it that easily clinically. You have to diagnose it by your response to loading and by your history.
That would make sense. Will you ever see a peritendon issue concurrently with a mid tendon issue?
Almost never.
Okay, that would make
sense. One will have preceded the other. You can see them together. In often an elite athlete who has originally has a tendon problem, you know, they have they don't want to load the tendon, so they start to use a bigger range of motion, they get weakness in their calf, and then their peritendon comes as a consequence of the bigger ranges of motion they've used. But for most people, no, the loads are so different. You know, you get peritendon problems from doing too much cycling, you don't ever get a tendon problem doing that, and vice versa. You know, you get tendon issues by, you know, sprinting up hills, you don't ever get a peritendon issue from that. Well, you could, but unlikely.
It'd be more so from like going out on a 5K cycle for the first time in a while, and that friction,
that's right,
the pedals,
yes,
that would make,
yes,
sense. Now,
yes,
even though we see more patellar tendinopathy in the young jumping athletes, and more Achilles tendinopathy can be sort of whenever, you could have it, you know, at a middle age, later age, athlete, non-athlete. Sort of the same premise though is that the tolerance capacity of the tendon will still be overwhelmed by one specific act, usually of overload, correct?
That's right. It can be one act. It can be, it can take more time. So, you know, you decide that you want to run a marathon and you go out and you start what you think is a gentle increase. You just do it too quickly. So you might get away with a week of running, but the second week it starts to get a bit irritable because you've jacked up your kilometers too quickly. So it's more common for it to be two or three lower overloads and one single overload, but it can be either. But it will be a load that exceeds what the tendon is used to.
That's, that makes sense.
A simple premise.
That makes sense. Now, here's the one question that so many people, I've heard this time and time again. What role does foot mechanics and overpronation have in effect to Achilles tendinopathy? Because when you look in the research, the only thing I found in my digging was a 1984 article that was peritendinopathy and I think Achilles tendinitis. They still refer to it as a tendinitis. And they said that when there's excessive pronation back and forth, it was creating a bowing effect of the Achilles tendon, and then that may lead to tendinopathy. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, there's pretty much no evidence that there's an association. No one has found that pronation has any relationship to Achilles tendons at tendinopathy, and no one has found that adding orthotics makes a difference. So there's a couple of randomized controlled trials where they've done orthotics and sham orthotics. Shannon Montano's study, they found no difference in outcomes. Both groups got exercise. So there's pretty much no evidence that it's a factor. You're much more affected if you have a supinated rigid foot. Dorsiflexion range is a critical factor in both Achilles and patella tendon. It's about having the joint range and the joint capacity to absorb the shock of landing so that your tendon doesn't have to take it all. If you have a stiff foot and a stiff ankle, then the tendon takes the load. So that's much more associated with an Achilles tendinopathy than a pronated foot. And as I say, there's pretty much no evidence that changing pronation is going to make any difference at all to your Achilles tendon problems.
Very interesting. So as far as, like you said, with the ankle range of motion, so if we have someone who has very limited ankle range of motion, in all a lot of the talks that I taught, give out with people when we're talking squat mechanics, obviously limited ankle mobility can have dramatic effects on the ability to maintain our biomechanics and correct alignment. But if we're talking about tendon load, if someone has limited ankle mobility, if they're doing, for example, consecutive box jumps or something like that, where they're using the spring-like capacity of the Achilles to pop right back out, how does that limited ankle mobility affect and the Achilles? And are we likely to see mid-tendon or more insertional tendinopathy issues because of that limited ankle range of motion?
Usually you will see more mid-tendon issues because you have limited dorsiflexion, you actually have to absorb your landing and your energy storage loads very much quicker. You haven't got the range to absorb it over time. So the tendon will take most of the load. And in fact, you're probably protected from insertional problems because it is dorsiflexion that creates the insertional problems in the first place. So you're much more likely to get a mid-tendon problem with that sort of overload than you are an insertional problem.
That makes sense. So I guess going along those lines, someone comes to us, they have an Achilles tendon issue. In our screening process, we find that they have also limited ankle mobility. Now, in our first steps of the treatment process, across all types of tendinopathy, at least Achilles tendinopathy, if we're talking insertional or mid-tendon, sort of, I guess we'll throw the peritendon issues off to the side for a second. With those two, isometrics are still going to usually be our first line of defense as far as our rehab plan. And body weight alone is sufficient for that, correct? Is that what you mentioned earlier?
Yeah. For a lot of people we see, and we probably see quite a unique group, and we see what we call the desperate and dateless, people who've had tendon problems for a long time and not got better. So most people we see are so dysfunctional, so weak, so lacking in endurance, really can't even lift their body weight decently once, let alone multiple times. So for those people and for people who are coming into some sort of program, body weights can be enough. And sometimes it's even and double leg, they're so weak, but single leg will do it. For our higher end athletes, it needs to be single leg with additional weight. Now, it needs to be standing, and it needs to be close towards dorsiflexion to get the maximum load on the tendon. Now, the only time you have to adjust that is if it's an insertional problem or if it's a plantaris problem where you need to be up a little bit higher to take away the compression, the compressive loads. So isometrics are worth a go. Now, you know, for every Twitter fight I have about this, you know, isometrics are overstated, et cetera, et cetera. It's a starting point for a rehabilitation program. It helps people's pain. It helps the brain. For goodness sake, try them. If it doesn't work, then move. Then rethink your diagnosis or move on. You know, we're not advocating that isometrics are the only thing that you do. We might use them solely or in isolation for maybe for a week, and then we'll move people onto heavy soil resistance. So I just can't advocate enough that, you know, people seem to think I say isometrics are the answer to tendons. They're not. They're a good starting spot. They're a really good diagnostic test. And then you need to actually develop a proper rehabilitation.
It's a part of the solution, not the entire solution in itself.
It's a very small part of the solution.
Yeah.
The biggest thing that you can do for a tendon is the heavy slow resistance training. Most people with an Achilles problem, if you give them a decent strength and strength endurance program, will feel tons better. Isometrics are a way of getting them started on a program, of giving them a way of helping their pain when they're not with you.
Now, you said one thing with the isometrics. You said they need to be in standing and they need to be close to end range dorsiflexion. Is that correct?
No. Towards dorsiflexion.
Towards dorsiflexion. Now,
yes.
What is the reason behind having them in standing versus the seated? Now, obviously, we're changing the gastroc, taking that maybe out of it, and maybe in seated. doing a little bit more soleus work, is that going to change then the amount of force that's being placed through the Achilles? Is that the reason behind that?
Absolutely, absolutely. So the Achilles is a synthesis of your soleal and your gastroc fibers. If you take gastroc out, then you must be halving the load. And that's the evidence, is it's about half the load in seated as it is in standing.
So would you say, therefore, in the heavy, slow resistance strengthening protocol that we would then do after the isometrics, that a soleus press where we're maybe holding a weight on our knee maybe doesn't have as much of an effect, or at least isn't as good of a choice as maybe a standing where you're holding for that reason?
That's about 27 questions in one. So from an isometric perspective, you're going to be better in standing.
Okay.
From a heavy, slow resistance perspective, you need to address both the soleus and the gastrocnemius muscle. So you need to do both.
Gotcha.
So it just depends on what part of the program that you're in as to whether you would do seated or standing or both or whatever. You know, some people, we start with seated isometrics because they're so deconditioned that we can't actually start them with standing ones. So, you know, you can have that scenario as well. Can I advocate very strongly, as much as I hate wall squats for patella tendon, I detest a weight on the knee for soleus. It really doesn't give us anything. You need to have a proper seated calf raise. You can use a Smith machine with a bar across your knee, or you can use a leg extension machine where you face the leg extension and you put the bolster on top of your knee. A weight on the knee is not going to cut it in terms of the right amount of load.
Very interesting. And then circling back to obviously the start of our rehab program with Achilles tendinopathy, and we found that person that has the limited ankle mobility, why is it not a good idea to stretch when you have limited ankle mobility?
Okay. So first, stretching has been shown to do absolutely nothing from an injury prevention perspective. From a tendon perspective, we tend to be wary because, A, it will increase the compression at the insertion, so we would never use it for an insertion. We would never use it for a peritendon issue because we want to limit the movement, not to continually throw it through bigger ranges of motion. And we would never use it for a plantaris-associated Achilles because that increases the compression as well. So there's three out of the four Achilles presentations where stretching is not going to help us and, in fact, can make us worse. So... And in the fourth condition, which is a pure Achilles mid-tendon, there's absolutely no evidence it works anyway. So I would much rather say don't bother with that, do some strength work. And if you think you have an issue with the muscle tendon length, you're going to get much more bang for your buck from doing your exercises towards the dorsiflexion range, if that's what's appropriate, but muscle work. So massage and dry needling and all of those things at the muscle end. You're not going to change tendon length in any way, shape, or form by stretching. It's pretty much a waste of time.
But then like banded joint mobilizations where we're more so trying to work on the joint mechanics and not necessarily stretch the tendon, that would be doable at that time.
Perfect. Gotcha. Perfect. Adjuncts are great for tendon injury. So muscle-based adjuncts, joint-based adjuncts, you know, taping-based adjuncts, whatever you want to chuck at it is fine as long as you get the loading right. And that's where people go wrong, is they use all of the adjuncts and none of the loading. And you can't do that. It's just not going to work.
Now, I know what your answer is probably going to be to this next question, but I've seen too many therapists that love to use the fancy like Graston technique and ASTEM to the actual tendon, whether that is Achilles tendon or the patellar tendon. Why is that such a bad idea? And what can we talk about that?
Okay, so I'm trying to think of a reason why you would do it. I can think of lots of reasons why you wouldn't do it, but let's start with the reasons why it would help. And often I'm quoted back that it's going to stimulate collagen and heal the tendon. Well, that's rubbish. Tendons don't heal, and that is not going to stimulate collagen production as much as taking collagen supplements. Are not going to make any difference either. Don't start me. And you're going to bring vascularity to the area. Well, tendons are hypervascular. They already have enough vascularity. In fact, they've got too much of the damn stuff, so you don't want to do that either. From the converse, why it can be a bad idea. If your cells are reactive, and assuming that that's the source of your pain, you can increase that. You can increase the irritability of the peritendon cells. They're very much more sensitive than tendon cells. So you're actually irritating those as well. So you can actually increase the reactivity, in inverted commas, by doing that. So there is no benefits and there is potential for harm. Now, one thing you can do, people get short-term pain relief from that because all of the nerves are in the peritendon, in the peripheral part of the tendon in the peritendon. If you do those techniques hard enough, you give them a short-term neuropraxia so they feel less pain for a period of hours, occasionally up to days. But all you're doing is changing the nerves. You're not changing the tendon. You're not making it better. You'd be much better spending your time in the gym.
That makes total sense. If we circle back to the Achilles tendon again, the first time we talked about the mid tendon and the insertional tendinopathy, if someone presents to you with the peritendon pain, we know that their Achilles complex is flared up due to the low load, sort of repetitive dorsiflexion, plantar flexion from maybe a long bike ride or on maybe a row machine for a really, really long time. As far as treatments, I know that you have talked about advocating for a heel raise similar to what we would use for insertional tendinopathy. Can you speak to what that heel raise does? Exactly.
Yeah, just for both of them, it changes the range that the tendon has to go through. So for a peritendon, if excess movement has created the problem, giving people a heel raise will decrease the amount of movement. Now, the important thing is that we're not talking a 6 mil insert here. We're talking 3 to 4 centimetres. So put that into American, 1.5 inches. So a big heel raise. Outside the shoe, a pair of shoes with a big heel basically is what you're after. So that will decrease the movement of the tendon. That will allow the whole thing to stay a little bit less irritable. So you'll stop irritating it. Now for the insertion, excuse my computer, for the insertion, the heel raise, similar size, actually takes the compression load away from the tendon. So you can do all the tensile load in that higher position. That reduces the load on the insertion, the compressive load on the insertion, and that really changes people's pain.
How long do you want to leave that insertion in for someone dealing with either or?
Peritendon can settle relatively quickly, depends how quickly you get it. So that may only be a couple of weeks. But for an insertion where the tendon's quite swollen and they're very painful, sometimes we will advocate 6 to 8 weeks up fairly high. That allows you to stop irritating the tendons, take the compressive loads away. And if you put a lot of tensile load, so your isometrics and your heavy slow resistance, the tendon will start to get a little bit finer. It'll start to lose its irritability and then you are less compressed as you pull them down. So it can be quite a few weeks.
Okay. Would you, during that rehab plan, would you recommend decreasing that heel height and taking that out while we're sort of in the midst of doing the heavy slow resistance work before we ever get back to plyometrics? They should be able to tolerate all that first?
Yes, yes. Depending on what your outcome is, what you want that person to be able to do, as you work through that heavy, slow resistance, strength, endurance type phase, you want to be slowly pulling that heel raise down. Now, sometimes we never get below about 2 centimetres. So if somebody's just a walking athlete, we get them a really nice pair of shoes with a reasonable heel and cut them loose at 2 centimetres. If they're a football player, be that soccer or Australian rules or American football, they're often in a completely zero shoe. So you actually have to get them right down to zero. That can be quite problematic, and sometimes we're forced to slightly alter the shoe in some way to allow them a little bit more of a heel raise. But yes, you're right. To be back doing your plyometric type activities for an Achilles insertion, you have to be able to do that in a relatively flat shoe, in inverted commas. Having said that, Achilles insertion problems are usually middle-aged to older people. So they're often not trying to sprint around the football field.
I'm just thinking of one client right now that I'm working with who just turned 40, and he is working towards qualifying for the CrossFit Games next year. Has been dealing with insertional tendinopathy for a long time. And he's got maybe right now about a half an inch, a couple centimeter, I guess, heel lift in right now that helps him as we're sort of working through things. But obviously with the goal of slowly tapering that down as we're easing back into higher level plyometrics would then therefore be the goal, correct?
That's right. That's right. And it's always a bit of this and a bit of that, you know, you get his strength and strength endurance, his plyometrics up, and then you try and reduce the heel raise. Sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. Sometimes you have to change your plyometric loads as your heel comes down. So, you know, with tendons, the other adage is only change one thing at a time, because if you change two things at a time, you never know what's going to flare the tendon up. So
makes sense.
If you decrease his heel height, keep his plyometrics the same. If you increase his plyometrics, keep his heel height the same. You know, so that you actually know which of those things is giving you the trouble.
Makes sense. A little bit of that trial and error clinically to find out exactly what the right mix is, because everyone's going to respond a little bit differently based on a variety of factors.
Absolutely.
Besides the heel raise for a paratendon injury, are there any other specific recommendations for the rehab process? Because obviously they're going to respond a little bit differently because it's not necessarily an overload like it would be for mid-tendon versus insertional. What other recommendations for the rehab process would you have?
So you just can't let them lose anything. So often they're an acute onset. So you would need to be doing lots of isometrics just because you're not because you're trying to change pain. You haven't got tendon pain, so you're not trying to change pain, but you're trying to maintain some muscle tendon capacity so that when they come back into a loading environment, they haven't lost very much. So you would be looking at the kinetic chain, make sure you don't lose anything up through the kinetic chain. Work on some very small range, heavy, slow resistance if you can. And we advocate for some heparinoid creams. I don't know if you can get them in the US, but we find very good results with a heparinoid application overnight for a couple of nights. That seems to work very well for them.
It makes sense to have still some of that isometric load or heavy, slow resistance, whatever they can tolerate without pain, because if they only put the heel raise in and they only rest for a few weeks, like you said, and then go back to their normal training, be it even possibly anything with load, they could have deconditioned their tendon, decreased their load tolerance, and then they wind up with a mid-tendon or insertional tendinopathy after that.
Exactly, exactly. And what we find with peritendons is they've got a massive memory. So you irritate your peritendon once, it just sits there waiting to get irritable again. There seems that the cell sensitivity is ramped up for months, and you have to be so careful with loading these people as you reinstitute load, because you will irritate that peritendon again unless you're very careful.
Very interesting. Are there any specific, I would guess I say, milestones or requirements for a patient coming back? They're through the sort of the heavy, slow resistance phase. We're thinking about slowly adding in plyometrics. Are there any things you want to see, be it with patellar tendinopathy, Achilles tendinopathy, that that person has to be able to do in order to start plyometrics?
Yep. So you want to see, obviously, pretty profound changes in strength and strength endurance. They may not be as good as the other side, but they want to be fairly close to the other side. Muscle bulk will often take much, much longer, so we don't usually use that as a milestone. But what we want to see is isolated kinetic chain function that will take a higher load. So what we see when we assess these people initially is really dysfunctional hopping strategies, very dysfunctional chain correction strategies. We want to see that back to something resembling normal, because if it's not normal and you put them back into a faster program, they're going to fail. So strength and strength endurance as a component needs to be substantially better, but a functional kinetic chain in an isolated fashion has to be there before you can actually put them into a plyometric program.
Interesting. And then once we do get back into that plyometric program, Is there a recommendation for specifically how much rest you're going to want to see between those plyometric days? Because obviously the plyometric load is going to place much more load on the tendon than we were with the heavy, slow resistance work.
Yeah, absolutely. So we advocate initially for 2 to 3 sessions a week of plyometric loads. And this is the time where quantifying your load is so important, because this is the load that's going to irritate the tendon. So we count everything, count jumps, count sprints, count meters, count everything we can, so that our load is progressive and we're doing a little bit more each day, each time we load it. If they're tolerating it every third day, then you can try every second day, or you can leave them every third day and increase the loads more. But it seems that the tendon in these early stages certainly can't take plyometric loads every day. So this is where we would do a faster day, a heavy, slow resistance day, because we always keep heavy, slow resistance in the program, and then maybe an endurance day. So, you know, we would vary the week. We want a load on the tendon every day. We just want it to be a different load.
So could you have maybe a plyometric day followed by heavy, slow resistance and maybe still put in those isometrics at all at that time? Or are you maybe sort of stopping isometrics by that last time?
Okay, so the isometrics are great in the early stages to change pain.
Okay.
But what we also know about them is they change cortical inhibition. And a lot of our athletes, particularly with patellar tendon, have a lot of unloading that's driven by the brain, because it hurts. Every time you load it, it hurts, so the brain says stop using it. Mm-hmm. Now, that inhibitory drive seems to be very strong in tendons, and so the isometrics change the inhibition. So often advocate them prior to a strength program to allow you to access your motor drive. So we know that immediately post isometric exercise, you're 19% stronger, and that's purely and simply because you can actually access the motor neurons. So we would advocate your isometrics prior to a strength program, especially if we felt that there was real inhibitory strategies going on. Your isometrics prior to a plyometric program can, if you start to get a little bit of pain, sometimes they can be, you can get a little bit of pain, they can alter that pain, give the person a little bit more confidence in the plyometric program. So it would be very much dictated by the person. Realizing, of course, isometrics, if you do them properly, take a little bit of time. We would absolutely do them in someone who was getting benefit from them. If we didn't think someone was getting benefit from them in that phase, we wouldn't do them.
That would make sense. I guess general recommendation, obviously it's hard to speak to a very, you know, general case like this, but for example, you have an athlete that maybe is an Olympic weightlifter or a CrossFitter and they're getting close to competition time. They're ramping up their intensity while their volume's lowering, or if they're in CrossFit, maybe doing a lot more volume work as well, depending on what they're trying to improve in their developing the patellar or the Achilles tendinopathy. They're not at the point where they want to take themselves out of working on, you know, they're working towards their competition because it's a very high level competition. They've been working for a long time. What recommendations do you have for that athlete at that time? Is there anything they can do at that time? Or is it just sort of one of those things you may have to wait and push through it and then we'll start your treatment process afterwards?
Okay. So pushing through tendon pain is just a stupidity, basically. Pain is the tendon telling you it is not dealing with the loads you're putting on it. Mm-hmm. So it's not a benign thing. It's actually the tendon trying to give you the heads up that something's not quite right. So what you need to do is change your load. Now, if you are at that higher end, you start to mess a bit with what loads you're doing. You might try and decrease your volume. You might take 1 or 2 exercises out, or you just drop a session a week. You give that tendon a little less load in some way. Now, in terms of what affects tendons best, frequency of loading is the most important thing, so 1 less session a week. Intensity would be the next thing, so take out the really high tendon loads or decrease the really high tendon load exercises, and then volume, train for a little bit less each time. And each time you change something, see what the tendon tells you about it. And so if the tendon says, well, I kind of like that load, it wasn't too bad, then you start to be towards what that tendon's capable of. But if you continue to ignore it, it's just going to get worse and worse and worse and worse. And you're going to have to decrease your load anyway to because you can't do it. Tendon pain stops you doing things. So you would much better to be proactively finding out the load it's not liking and changing that rather than wait for the tendon to force you to change something.
So the idea of trying to add in an isometric to get the cortical inhibition so you can continue pushing through would not be a good idea, because that's what I hear some people will try to do, because they hear the idea that the isometric will often decrease pain, and then they just continue with their current workload. That would be a very bad idea long term, is what you're saying.
Yeah. Use your isometrics for competition, use your isometrics when you have to do something. Mm-hmm. But, you know, isometrics change pain and they change cortical inhibition. They're not helping decrease the load on the tendon. The pain's there because the tendon is not tolerating the load. So you have to change the load. And look, if you were a week out from your competition and you really didn't want to change anything, then sure, try your isometrics. But if you're 6 weeks out, you're on a one-way trip to nowhere, because it's going to get you eventually, and it will always get you the week before your competition.
Yeah. If
you try and push through then.
Yeah. And like you said, recommend maybe changing just one variable at a time and seeing. Yep. So like taking down just maybe one day out of your training frequency a week and not changing frequency, volume, you know, intensity, not changing all three, because you don't know which one changed and you just completely changed your training program. So whereas maybe just one variable alone may have been enough to knock down your pain. Very good.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, very interesting. Now, I know I have just a few questions left. I don't want to keep you too long. I know we talked about how just the wall sits alone is not enough of a load for patellar tendinopathy. Are there many other, I guess you would say, things that physical therapists and physiotherapists that you see they do incorrectly when it comes to the treatment process, like doing wall sits instead of doing a knee extension where you're going to get enough load? Are there any other big things where you see physios and physical therapists miss the boat?
Yep. Pretty much what we've talked about. Getting the diagnosis wrong. Treating the wrong source of pain would be most common thing we see. So not paying enough attention to a good history and a good clinical examination. That would be the first thing. The second thing would be not enough load. So as soon as somebody has a tendon problem, the go-to is unload them. The go-to should be to load them in the appropriate way. And so we see people who've been taken off their weights, see people who've been told not to do a whole range of things, see people who've been told to stretch and, you know, have all the passive treatments. That's just not going to work. So it's much more likely that they're unloading these people than they're overloading them. They would be the two biggest things by far. Relying on imaging and palpation as your diagnosis will not get you anywhere. In terms of exercises, I think I've said it, you know, the old weight on the knee using the seated thing is not a really good idea. TheraBand, my goodness, could I ban that stuff in 10 minutes? People seem to think that's a good loading exercise. It's just not going to be sufficient for most people. Yeah, they'd be the three big ones, I suppose.
What would you rather have someone do to strengthen the soleus than the classically used weight on top of the knee heel raise? What's a more efficient way?
A proper seated calf raise machine is what you need. Or you can use the Smith machine with a bar across the knee, or you can use the leg extension machine with the bolster from the leg extension machine on the top of your knee.
Interesting.
So, because both of those isolate, all of those isolate the load over the tibia. What happens when you stick great big weight over your leg is that the weight's distributed along your femur and the amount of load that's over your tibia is really relatively low. You've got to get the load over your tibia. Otherwise, logically, it makes no sense. And, you know, you can't actually, you know, if you put a weight on its edge and did it, you might get some, but you can't do that because you can't hold it and it hurts and you don't get a decent load and, you know, the whole thing falls apart.
That makes sense. Last question, as far as talking about load, how do you know you're using sufficient load? For example, we have someone, patellar tendinopathy, and we're in the heavy, slow resistance. Maybe we're using like a box squat. So we're not going to full depth. We're using a box squat, maybe a 5 second or 3 second eccentric and a 3 second concentric. How would you know that you're using the right weight or that you need to progress or decrease that?
So what we usually say clinically is that you should be able to complete your sets and reps with very good control, but you shouldn't be able to do another set. So we often give people 4 sets of 6, 4 sets of 8 of an exercise, that the end of their 4th set of 8, they are so fatigued in their muscle that they couldn't do another set, but they could do the 4th set with good control.
Okay.
So that's the way clinically we sort of work through it. And if you can get through the 4 sets of 8 and you're feeling like you could do a 5th, put your weight up. Don't ever change your sets and reps. Just keep putting your weight up.
Is it normal to have pain at that time, or should this be completely pain-free?
Tendons don't mind slow work. It's the faster stuff that irritates them. So heavy, slow resistance should be relatively pain-free. Again, another good diagnostic heads up. If heavy, slow resistance is making your pain worse, it's probably not tendon pain. And so all of the heads up that you need to actually get your diagnosis right. Your isometrics will give it to you, history, your examination, isometrics, but your heavy, slow resistance will clearly tell you whether it's tendon or not.
So if we're talking purely the squat, a full depth squat, then by that definition should not create more pain if it's purely tendon related than a half squat. Is that correct? Or will the full depth squat, because of the is there more tension placed on the tendon down there?
Yes, there is. I'm a big advocate in the patella tendon for a tibia, a vertical tibia load. So it seems that as soon as you pull the tibia forward, so you place the knee over the foot, you get into trouble. So I'm a big one for your Bulgarians, your backward squat type of thing. You can take the sorest patella tendon and give them a walk lunge and they will not have any problem with it at all. It's as soon as you go into a squat forward that the tendon doesn't like it. So for the patella tendon, always backwards. The other reason I'm not a big fan of squats is they're usually done double leg and you involve 3 joints on each side. So if you've got one joint that's not working, one muscle tendon unit that's not working well, it hides. So we would always go single leg. We would always go isolated and then we would put it back together, but we'd still go single leg. And for the patella tendon, we'd always go more for the back squat Bulgarian type rather than the forward squat.
That would make sense. Well, I have to say thank you so much. It's been about an hour. This has been one of the best interviews so far. Just the amount of content that we covered is amazing. Thank you so much. I know that you are on Twitter and that you're not on too many other social media things. If anyone wants to learn more of your work, what are the best places to go and find it?
I'm pretty good at hiding, actually. So, you know, we focus on the research. We do courses around the world. So as many times as we can get out of Australia to come and do a course, I'm doing one in Texas in May this year. No, next year, 2019. Often in Europe, in South America. But unfortunately, I don't run a website. I don't run a blog. I don't do any of that sort of stuff. So I don't know how you find out where I am, actually. Probably a good thing.
Well, I'll try to share as much of your content as possible, because I know it's been instrumental in my learning of tendon injuries and how others can use your information to help heal their own injuries. So again, thank you so much. And for all the listeners out there, I hope you enjoyed today's podcast. If you did like it, please share it all across social media, tag me in it so I can personally reach out and say thank you for listening. Until next week, guys, happy squatting.
That's it for today, class, on Squat University by Dr. Aaron Horschig. For more exclusive content, log on to squatuniversity.com.